microwaved coffee.
So my favorite comic book is this comic book called Invincible.
Invincible, okay.
And they made a cartoon of it on Amazon. Mm-hmm. And it's really good. The art is basically the same art as the comic book, but it's just like in motion, like a cartoon. So If you like superhero stuff and you haven't read that comic book, because it ended, it's made by the guy who did Walking Dead, the comic Walking Dead.
Oh, okay.
Oh, cool.
And he's also, I believe he's writing the show.
Oh, so he's maybe working on it.
Produce it. Yeah, and it's really good. The first three episodes are on Amazon right now, and I think they're going to start every Friday doing an episode. Mm-hmm. So I watched that. I'm halfway through the Chicago 7 or whatever right now, and I watched RoboCop.
Cool.
I love RoboCop.
Just as.
Yeah, and it still holds up.
Cool.
Nice.
It's ridiculous, but it still holds up.
Yeah.
God, what else? I feel like I've been watching a lot of TV, but yeah.
I feel like I have too, but I can't think of
a single show. Right now. Oh. We watched The Falcon and Winter Soldier. And
how was that?
It's
Wait, what's that on?
Okay, that's on Disney Plus.
Oh, okay.
New episode every Friday. It's okay right now, but it's funny because they announced that it's like the most watched show on Disney Plus, and I was like,
oh, it's a show. I thought it was a movie.
Yeah, no, it's a show, and so far I think WandaVision is better than that show, but
huh,
I don't know.
Kyle watched the Snyder Cut of Justice League.
Oh yeah, I was gonna ask him about that because it's like 4 hours long or something, right?
Yeah.
I
saw like a part of it. I'm not really interested in like superhero stuff, but I don't know. I think Zack Snyder just does an amazing job at comic movies. Like his movies are stunning. Like I think to a certain level for someone like me who's not interested in that stuff, his movies can like keep my attention because they're. Yeah, I don't know. I really like them, but
I liked Watchmen because that was one of my favorite graphic novels growing up. And then,
dude, Watchmen was so accurate to the actual graphic novel.
Yeah,
it was crazy. It was like frame by frame.
Yeah. That's why I think a lot of people didn't like it because it doesn't like translate well, I guess, to be entertained. But it's entertaining for me because I knew that comic book pretty well. And then I liked Man of Steel, but I didn't like, what is it, Superman versus Batman? That one was boring.
Yeah.
I didn't either. I thought at first it was just me, but I remember we went to go see it with, I think Justin, Aaron, Abe, and I went to go see it. And I thought I was the only one, and I was like, and they were like, that was really boring. And I was like, yeah, okay, I wasn't the only one.
Yeah, so what I've been sort of finding, like kind of putting together is that so people like the extended version of that movie, the Batman versus Superman, which is basically like the Snyder Cut. And then for this one, the Justice League, his daughter passed away, so they were saying that that's why he didn't finish it, but it's been recently kind of rumored that he got fired.
Mm-hmm.
And so Joss Whedon took over and just finished the movie, and it sucked. So then because of online, like Twitter, they brought him back to finish it, and he reshot a bunch of things. And
So Batman vs. Superman, when I was working at CNN, my friend Marcos, who's a huge comic book fan, he was like, he begged me to watch the extended version of Batman vs. Superman because he was like, they destroyed that movie. Like, he was like, Snyder's version is so much better. And I never saw the extended version, but I heard that from a lot of people. And so when Justice League came out, I told Kyle, I was like, you know, Marcos recommends that you watch this if you're really into it, because apparently his is like a lot truer to the story, and it's, you know, more interesting. And So yeah, it was, but Kyle said it was good. He only regrets not watching the other films before because he was kind of lost on some parts. Like he's like, oh, I don't remember who that is. Or, he didn't remember the characters and stuff, but,
then, but I've been reading that, well, like all the DC movies suck compared. And well, if the studio made him edit Batman versus Superman and it wasn't good, and they made him they did a bad edit of Justice League, and then his versions are good. I'm like, why don't they just let people direct?
Yeah,
it's really annoying. I don't know. They're acting like they did back in like the 40s and 50s, where the producers were the directors, and it's like, just let them do their job. Like they know what they're doing.
Yeah,
and you don't, you know?
So people are fighting right now because it's been pretty well known since before Suicide Squad came out, the first one, that the studio basically, like, cut it apart. And so now people are fighting to get the director's version of the first Suicide Squad.
Who directed that? Do you know?
I forgot his name.
But it's not Zack Snyder.
No. Yeah. Ayer? I don't remember. But it's not Zack Snyder, but it's in that same world. And it wasn't meant to be funny, but when Guardians of the Galaxy came out, the studio was like, make it funny.
Is one thing, like, when I started watching the Marvel movies, like, I shouldn't have an opinion on Marvel movies, but when I first started watching them, that is one thing that drove me up the wall. Like, stop trying to be funny. This is not like a comedy. This is not like a slapstick. Like, just stick to the story.
Well, Guardians of the Galaxy is pretty funny because James Gunn is funny. So, like, his style.
Oh, I loved
it. Mm-hmm. You know, he's funny. Same thing with Ant-Man. You know, it's funny because Paul Rudd rewrote the script. And so it's funny. Things like that. Like, those are funny because they're just funny. And then, like.
But with, like, Joss Whedon. And stuff, it's like I know he's done a lot of things, but it's like,
but he only did Avengers and Age of Ultron, which aren't funny. Like, they're not meant to be funny. But the last, like, Endgame and Infinity War had some jokes, but that's because the directors, like the Russo brothers, sometimes are pretty funny. So it just, like, I feel like Marvel lets the directors do what they let them, you know, like, lets their style come out.
Yeah.
But they try to keep, like, all the movies kind of have the same.
Like, yeah, they don't see films as, like, these independent stories. They're like, hey, it worked for this movie, so let's make this one the same. And it's like, no, just let them do what they needed to.
And that's why I feel like DC is, like, trying to catch up to Marvel instead of just making a movie.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, because a lot of people were like, I didn't see Suicide Squad. I saw Batman versus Superman, but a lot of people were saying, oh, they were blaming it on, like, the act, like, they're blaming it on Jared Leto's version of Joker, or they were blaming it on Ben Affleck.
Come out.
Yeah, and they were blaming it on, like, Ben Affleck's version of Batman, and I'm like, I assure you, they are not the problem. Like, I was like, I watched Batman versus Superman. Ben Affleck was not the problem. And I'm not one to, like, stand up for Ben Affleck, but I'm like, he's not the problem with that movie. Like, he was not. It was just boring. Like, it wasn't
him. It was
boring,
yeah. And the first Suicide Squad, I think if they would have put more shots of the Joker, it probably would have been a better movie. Because he's literally, like, in two or three scenes.
That's what I heard. He was, like, barely in it, and they put him in the trailers. Like, he was in the whole movie.
And they shot, he says they shot, like, 6 hours, like, worth of, like, footage.
That's crazy.
And so, like, they took his parts out because people didn't like the way he looked. So the studio was like, okay, we got to put less Joker in the movie.
Okay. It's like, as a comic book fan, since you're a comic book fan, my opinion, as not such a big comic fan, is that, like, I don't get this way they look problem. Like, don't they evolve in the comics?
Yeah,
aren't
they
like different versions?
Yeah.
So it's like, I don't, when people were, like, freaking out about Joker, I was like, but that's that version of it. Like, it's, you know.
It's, to me, it's like a, I have a big issue with a lot of stuff that people say, because the amount of comic book fans that there are now is BS, especially people around my age. Mm-hmm. Or like our age, basically, is BS, because growing up, people made fun of me for reading comics. I'm like, the majority of people did not read comic books.
As someone who has attended Comic-Con since 1998, I will completely like agree with you. That's so bullshit. Like, nobody used to go to Comic-Con. Nobody used to go. And they weren't going for the comics. Like, everyone started going when celebrities started showing up.
Yeah, I used to go for the comics. I usually would come out with stacks of comics.
Mm-hmm. And it became like cool, you know.
Yeah, or because that was your eBay before eBay. Like, you couldn't find comics on every comic book store, but you, when you would go to Comic Con, you would find rare comics. So, anyway, what annoys me is that all these people have opinions now based on stuff they didn't care about. You know, so yes, like now that it's popular, you have an opinion, and then my opinion, just watch the movie, and shut up. Because the fact that they made these movies all work together was what I've always wanted as a kid. And those people didn't even think about this being an idea growing up.
Yeah.
No, yeah.
So, like, it's annoying.
Yeah, it's like the same issue I have with the Oscars. Like, there's all of a sudden all this controversy. And I'm like, do you watch the Oscars? No. Did you watch the movies? No. What are you fucking complaining about? Like, it drives me. I remember when they were talking about, you know, having more representation. And I was like, did you watch Moonlight? No.
Yeah.
Did you watch any? And I named like five, you know, black directed written movies. No. Okay, what are you fucking complaining about? Because Black Panther didn't get nominated for Best Picture. Like, what are you talking about?
And also, that year that they complained was the year before Black Panther. And I was like, because Will Smith didn't get nominated for Concussion. And I'm like, did you see Concussion?
Oh, yeah.
Do you think that he should have been nominated after, like, he got nominated for, what's that one movie? The Happiness or whatever?
Pursuit of Happiness.
Yeah.
Oh, Pursuit of Happiness, yeah.
Yeah.
You think you're going to compare that movie to Concussion just because it's a drama? No, he didn't do that good of a job as he did in Pursuit of Happiness. Like, at least in my opinion.
It does. Yeah. It drives me kind of... Like, I totally agree that there's... That people are, like, underrepresentation. I totally get that. There are not enough people of color working in film. But... Yeah, but you can't come at me with that argument if you are if it's just because they are people of color. Like, to me, that's more insulting.
That's what
than
I think.
Giving them credit, like Get Out won for best script because it was the best script. Like, it was a brilliant script, and it's like he didn't win because he was a black man. Like, he won because it was a great film. And and it just drives me crazy, and people don't watch these movies.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, don't fucking come at me with this like controversy if you've never been into it. And then the thing about Black Panther that drove me crazy is like, have you ever watched the Oscars? Because no superhero movie has ever been nominated. Like, I don't.
Yeah, it definitely just got, because I don't even think it's the best one.
I don't either.
Of the Marvel movies, it's good, but it's not the best one. But it got nominated because of the whole situation or whatever.
I got in so many arguments with people about Black Panther because I was like, no. If a superhero movie is going to be nominated, it better fucking be Logan.
Because I know, right?
If you're going to nominate a superhero movie, the first one better be Logan. Because I'm like, that movie was brilliant. It was so good.
I haven't seen that in a while.
Ah. So good. Remember when I watched the trailer like once a week?
Yeah.
The movie came?
Oh my god. Yeah. I think you like the trailer more than the movie, honestly.
Justin would be like upstairs and he'd hear like Johnny Cash, like his version of her, and he'd be like, here we go. So good.
And it didn't get nominated for anything.
Literally nothing. And I'm like, why? Why?
Yeah, it was that movie. So was good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I need to watch the new one. The Justice League, but I'm just like, where am I gonna get 4 hours in the day to freaking
it's so crazy. Like, I told Kyle, I was like, this is insane, like, that's so long. And like,
yeah,
Kyle was like, you watched Irishman like 30 times. And I'm like, yeah, but I'm unemployed. Like how are people with like lives supposed to watch this movie? Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking I might watch it like in pieces. I might have to watch it in pieces. Like
40 minutes here, an hour here.
Yeah.
Yeah, why not? Maybe watch it like a series, you know?
Yeah.
Oh my God, it's so funny.
Yeah.
But yeah, he liked it. That's good. Well,
Anyways,
this is Microwave Coffee Podcast. Superheroes. Yeah, superheroes. Superheroes and movies. yeah, this is Microwave Coffee Podcast, and I'm Kishan Sandy.
And I'm Ivan Ortega.
And I'm Justin Park.
So we're recording this on a Tuesday, and our episode is released on Thursdays. And Thursday's April Fool's Day.
Oh.
This is the end of the episode.
Bye.
So.
I was going to do my topic on April Fool's, but then I started searching it, and I started searching like April Fool's history, and it started talking about the early 1500s, and like a seventh grader with ADHD, I was like, nah, dude, I'm out. So I decided we're not going to talk about April Fool's, but we're going to learn about some comedy history. So let's talk about a man named Doug Kenny. Francis Kenny was born on December 10th, 1946 in West Palm Beach, Florida. He didn't live there for long after he was born. His family moved to Chagrin Falls in Cleveland, Ohio, a few years after he was born. And I couldn't find much on his childhood, really, aside from the fact that he attended like a Catholic high school, a private school in Ohio.
As every comedian should.
As every guy, yeah. they really got to get that drill down to be funny. Yeah. Sadly, around the time he was in high school, his older brother Daniel passed away of kidney disease. He was, I believe, 21, 22. And Doug kind of felt that his brother was a golden child, and he just never really lived up to his parents' expectations of him. So he had a difficult relationship with his parents. And Doug's dad, after he graduated high school, he got him a job at a country club because his dad was like a tennis pro. So he got him a job at a country club, and he would string rackets. And he said it really helped him because he would talk about working in customer service as, you know, us and anybody, any of the listeners who have worked in customer service know. It sucks, and it's like the worst. Later on, his friend, actor and writer Brian Doyle Murray, said that they would constantly talk about like customer service and working in customer service. And he said, quote, "We had a lot of talks about being service personnel and how people abuse you. And I remember I once barked at a waiter or waitress, and Doug gave me the longest lecture on my behavior, and he was right." So not only did it make him a little like tough and stand up for himself, but Doug was also a really, really nice guy. Like everyone who met him said he was just like the nicest. Later on, there was a reporter who got to do an interview with him, and she said it was like insane that she got to do an interview with him because she was 17. And so she's like, I don't know how I landed this gig, but at the time he was really famous. And so she said that when she sat and talked to him, this was back in the 70s. And, you know, of course, as a 17-year-old girl, she just expected people to just constantly hit on her, and especially older guys. And she said that when she sat with him, he treated her like a professional journalist and was like genuinely interested in her work and really talked to her about like his life experience and what he had gone through. So he was a really, really nice guy. Doug later on ended up attending Harvard. And at Harvard, he was part of the Signet Society, which is a group that focused on literary work. So it was like a club of writers, basically. It still to this day is. Then after being in the Signet Society, he became the editor of the world's oldest comedy magazine, the Harvard Lampoon. So, yeah. While at Harvard, Doug met an upperclassman named Henry Beard, and the two quickly became really good friends. In 1969, during their last year of school, they published a parody book called Board of the Rings. And the book was a huge hit. It was like a bestseller and really successful at the time. And actually, it even made a comeback when the Lord of the Rings films came out.
Oh, nice.
When the ones came out with the Peter Jackson ones.
Oh, yeah.
So Doug and Henry decided that they wanted to start their own magazine along with their friend Robert Hoffman. They licensed the name Lampoon from Harvard and called the magazine the National Lampoon. The first issue was published on April of 1970. Their first attempt didn't go great. They wanted to do a parody of Life magazine, and they ended up losing $200,000 in the publication of their first. Yeah, it was really bad.
What's that like now? $1 million.
Oh yeah, like a shit ton of money. Yeah. They were deeply in debt, and they tried looking for investors. A lot of investors didn't want to invest in a comedy magazine. This was a time when, you know, the Vietnam War was going on. Yeah. Like high political times, a lot of like serious issues, and so they saw it as like a waste of time, even though they had been really successful with their other, you know, their other writings and stuff. They finally found an investor that would give them money and really believed in them. His name was Matty Simmons, and he actually thought it was a great idea, and he really liked the whole parody thing. And part of the reasons that Simmons had faith in their idea was because he was also told that his magazine would not become successful when he published the first Weight Watchers magazine. So people were like,
interesting,
that's not going to work. Like, no one's going to read a magazine with recipes and like tips on how to lose weight. Yeah. And it worked. He made it really successful. And so he kind of believed in the guys and decided to invest with them. The magazine did have to change it a little bit after learning that their first one was just kind of like bombed. And so they still wanted to do a parody magazine, but they wanted to change a little bit of it. And they decided to now parody Time magazine as opposed to Life magazine. I don't really know the big difference between those. I always thought those two were like very similar, but
yeah, I thought they were the same basically.
Yeah, so they did a parody of Time magazine, and if you look up the early issues of National Lampoon, you can see the change in the artwork. So what happened was that they thought the magazine maybe didn't look like what they wanted to and like kind of match with their humor. And I'm not really sure how it happened in real life. I tried looking this up and it didn't really give me any information, but in the film A Futile and Stupid Gesture, they have that scene where they end up changing the artwork. So the storyboard artists that were working on the first issues of the magazine were very psychedelic. They had like crude art, like that very trippy, you know, on mushrooms type of art. So out of curiosity, they asked a storyboard artist from a family magazine, which was like a really serious magazine. It was not a comedy type thing. They asked him to do a version of their covers, the ones that they had originally, and they wanted to see how he interpreted the art. And when he did the art, he did a very deadpan. And so he did a lot of replicas of the guy who does the American, like, you know, like the American household. He did the Thanksgiving dinner painting. Oh my god, Norman Rockwell, that's what I'm thinking of. So he did a lot of, like, he did that version of their magazines, and it was really deadpan, but they ended up loving it because it really matched their dry humor. And so they ended up getting rid of the artist that did the like psychedelic type art and then changed it to a more serious art, which matched like their dry sense of humor. just to give you an example, one of their most popular covers is a dog with a gun pointed at its head, and the title reads, "If you don't buy this magazine, we'll kill this dog." And so, like, that was their kind of humorous. Yeah. The photographer who worked on that cover, because that wasn't a drawing, it was an actual picture of a dog with, like, a gun pointed at his head. The photographer who shot it is named Ronald G. Harris, and he said that that cover was really hard to shoot because it just looked sad. Like, he's like, this is really depressing. This is not funny at all. And so they had an idea to... So they would pose the dog with the gun at its head, and they had an idea to cock the gun. So it wasn't loaded, obviously, but to make the noise like that the gun is cocking. And the dog ended up looking at the, like, he didn't move his head, but he moved his eyes. And so it looked really funny because he looked like, what's going on? Like, really scared. Yeah. And so his eyes are just kind of looking towards the gun, but, like, his head has not moved. And it turned out it matched. It was, like, funny, and it became really successful. When describing the National Lampoon's humor, writer Thomas Carney said their mission was to disrespect everything, mostly yourself. So it was super offensive, comedy, dry humor, but also attacking. It was very, like, anti-establishment, but very sophisticated humor. And the magazine also had parody ads, comic strips, short stories. One of their ads, or one of their more popular ads, is an ad for Volkswagen. And Volkswagen actually ended up suing them because of this ad. But it's a Volkswagen bug floating on water. And it says, if Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, right? He's the one that got in the accident and his girlfriend drowned. I don't know if you guys know what I'm talking about.
No.
I think it's, yeah, Ted Kennedy. Basically, he got in a really, there's a movie called Chappaquiddick about this, but basically he got in a car accident and his girlfriend drowned and they tried covering it up. But he was drunk. He was, like, drunk driving. And so that's why he flew off a bridge and landed in a lake and she ended up dying. Yeah, it's really depressing. The parody ad read, if Kennedy had driven a Volkswagen, he would have been president today. Like, basically saying, like, the car would not have, like, sunk. Yeah. So yeah, that's kind of, like, their humor. One of their regular articles included an article called Miss Agnew's Diary. And I hope I'm pronouncing this right, but it was a joke on then Vice President Spiro Agnew, his wife, and it was as if she was chronicling the Nixon administration. So it was like a dear diary, like, today Nixon, like, it was just, like, ridiculous shit, right? Like, they were, like, making up. So that was one of them, just kind of, like, poking fun at the president. The magazine was getting super popular after those articles and after they started changing the artwork, and it ended up spawning other projects. This included the National Lampoon Radio Hour. And this was a radio show that was based on radio programs from the early 1900s, like when people used to gather around their radios and listen to stories. So they would do skits and stuff for the radio. And members of the group, of the radio show group, included Bill Murray, Michael O'Donohue, Gilda Radner, Chevy Chase, Christopher Guest, John Belushi, and Harold Ramis. That's just, like, a few of them. They had a lot of really famous comedians and writers in their group. And after that spawned another group called the National Lampoon Lemmings, where a lot of those cast members would actually perform live. It was like a live variety show. So they would play in bands. They would do, like, sketch comedy. And, yeah, it started becoming really, really popular. Now, Doug was super smart and witty. His friend Harold Ramis said that he would take books off the shelf and start reading them aloud, but just to, like, practice his comedy. So he would start reading them out loud, and then he would start improvising, and then no one would be able to tell where the book stopped and where his improvising began, because he was, like, so quick. And he was so good at parodying that they were like, oh my god, what is part of the story and what is what is he making up? Yeah, it's great. And he would like go back and forth with that. Unfortunately, he didn't like to show weakness, and he would take on a lot, so he would overwhelm himself with a lot of projects. And kind of being this punk that he is, he's really smart, but on the other hand, he's also like very anti-establishment. He was like a master procrastinator. Like, he was like always on the edge of the deadline and was kind of taking on too much, or on more than he should have. He also started doing a lot of drugs, like a lot of people did in the 70s.
I was gonna say, that's pretty normal.
Yeah, pretty normal for that time. And some people said that he would work 7 day 90 hour work weeks. Like, he it was insane. Jeez. Like, he was everywhere. He would go record the radio show. He would write the live performances. He would write for the magazine. I mean, he was just like doing too much. This took a huge toll on his relationship with his friends and his family. After only 3 years of marriage, he divorced his wife, Alexandra Appleton Garcia Mata, who he met during his last years of college. But it didn't stop him, and a lot of people were concerned, because after his divorce, he kind of took no time to, you know, grieve that relationship or to take a break. He went straight back to work the second it happened. He kept working and juggling several projects at once. The other problem was that because of his drug use and how eccentric he would disappear without notice. And he one time packed a small bag and visited his friends from college, Peter Ivers and Lucy Fisher, who were married. He ended up staying with them for months one time. Like, I think he stayed with them for like 6 months and didn't tell anybody. So he would just do this like MIA thing every once in a while. When he went to go visit his friends, or when he was gone for like a long time, he came back with a manuscript he had written for a book called Teenage Commies from Outer Space. And he asked his friend Henry Beard to read it. And when Beard gave him criticism, he took the manuscript and threw it out the window. And it was like a huge book. Like, he had been working on it for months, and instead of like tweaking it, he just like, no, it's trash, and just like threw it out.
Dang.
He, after that, started working with his colleague PJ O'Rourke and had an idea for a high school parody yearbook, like a high school yearbook parody. And they ended up doing one based on the stereotypes of high school. So like the jock, the cheerleader, the introvert. And it became a huge hit. It was really popular, a bestseller. Now, when they did the contract with Maddie Simmons, they had a buyout in their contract. It was scheduled for 5 years from when the magazine started. And so Simmons ended up buying them out for $7.5 million. That's $7.5 million at the time. So I don't know how much that is now, but it's like a shit ton of money. And Henry Beard just... he was just overwhelmed because Doug would just leave sometimes and leave him with all the work. And he was overwhelmed and didn't want to deal with all that. So he ended up leaving shortly after the buyout, according to sales, at least. National Lampoon's most successful period was 1973 to 1975. And after the buyout, and also after Henry left, a lot of the staff left. And actually, most of them went to go work for SNL, which was kind of sad. I mean, SNL just started back then. Yeah. And he was, you know, frustrated with the decline of the magazine, and also kind of angry at the success of SNL and that they basically took like his entire crew. So frustrated with all that, Doug wrote a film called Animal House, which we all know became a huge success. And it was actually shocking that it became a huge success, because the production of the movie was insane. He found it very difficult to work with like the suits, you know, with producers, because he wanted to do his own thing. He didn't like working with the big company. I think it was like Warner Brothers or Paramount, like one of those big companies. He allegedly got in a fist fight with one of their producers. like straight up punching them out over right. this. But yeah, but the movie was a huge success, and he got a shit ton of money for it. He was really successful after that, and he started working on the script for his second film, Caddyshack. When they started shooting Caddyshack, it was also like a crazy production. According to the cast and crew, there were drugs everywhere. Like, there was a budget for just cocaine, which was, I heard the same thing about Blues Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was like they had a straight up budget for coke, and it was just drugs everywhere. And so they're like, we don't know how he did it, but Doug Kenny, being like the hardworking guy that he is, would. They said that they would see him. Like, he'd be on coke, he'd be doing a bunch of drugs, but he'd still do his job, and he would be there, like, on the set 24 hours a day, and he would just, like, pass out on the lawn and take a nap, and then wake up and keep working. Like, he still did his work, even though he was, you know, working way, way too much.
Yeah.
And...
I mean, that's probably how he did the work, right? If he was doing coke, it's probably keeping him awake.
But, like, yeah, I guess so, but... You know, before he started doing drugs, he was still, like, really good, like, a really incredible writer and really creative. And the drugs, I think, made it a little more unstable because they just couldn't count on him. And there was no schedule or anything that they could, you know, follow.
Yeah.
The production was a mess, and Doug Kenny was not happy with the film. Like we talked about earlier, like, with the... you know, director's cut of movies. The production companies wanted to focus on the big stars of the movie, which were Bill Murray and...
Yeah, I was like, Caddyshack is such a good movie, though.
Yeah, so they changed it completely from his vision. So his vision of the movie, because he wrote the movie based off his experience working on a country club, so he wanted to make the movie about the caddies and how... these rich people are like assholes and they're the worst.
Mm-hmm.
But because Bill Murray was in it, and also because of, you know, all these huge actors, they wanted, you know, Rodney Dangerfield was in it and he played one of the actual golfers. They wanted to focus more on that. And so he wasn't happy with it. And it received terrible reviews. I know it's hard for us to believe now because we love that movie. Now it's like, such a popular movie and we all really love it, but back then it got like shit reviews. It was really bad. Critics kind of destroyed it in the papers, and at a press conference for Caddyshack, he showed up late and he was completely drunk, and then he started verbally abusing the reporters and eventually passed out in a drunken stupor.
Wow.
After that, his friends and family were getting really concerned because not only was he doing way too much drugs, he was, they kind of sensed that he was suffering with depression. He would joke about attempted suicides and about dying, and they begged him to seek help, but he just wouldn't do it because he, of course, like a lot of people, didn't think he had a problem. Chevy Chase was really good friends with him and thought that maybe if he took him away from like the Hollywood scene that it would help him out. So he took him to a trip to Hawaii and was kind of hoping that they would be because like Chevy Chase also was like a big drug user, so he was hoping that in Hawaii they could get clean, like they could maybe go some time without doing any drugs and just kind of relax and not think about work. Once they were in Hawaii, Doug didn't want to leave. He was like, this is paradise. This place is beautiful and I don't want to leave this place. So it was just him and Chevy Chase there. But then eventually Chase had to fly back for work. He had to go back home. And then shortly after Chevy Chase left, his Doug's girlfriend, actor Catherine Walker, went to go visit him. And she was there for a couple of days, but she also had to leave for work. So after she left, he got really lonely. And so he called Chevy back and he said, come back to Hawaii. Like, come hang out with me again once you're done with work. And so he agreed. And Chase was preparing to leave back to Hawaii to meet Doug when he received a phone call that Doug was missing. Sadly, Doug's body was discovered on August 30th, 1980, between some jagged rocks.
No.
Authorities determined that he had slipped and he fell off of, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Hanapepe Lookout, which is like a really popular, it's actually the place where they filmed Jurassic Park. That opening scene of Jurassic Park, mm-hmm. or not the opening, but when they first got there, that beautiful, yeah, that stuff is not Photoshopped. Like, that's what it actually looks like. So yeah, it's like gorgeous. Boy. And the death was ruled an accident. Doug Kenny was 33 years old. When they announced his death, or his accidental death, Harold Ramis was heard saying, yeah, Doug probably fell while he was looking for a place to jump. So yeah, he wasn't totally sure that it was accidental. Because he was like, I don't know. In his hotel room, they found a piece of paper with Doug's handwriting that said, quote, these are some of the happiest days I've ever ignored. And that's it. Sadly, that is the story and tragic ending of Doug Kenny. The last National Lampoon magazine was published in 1990, I believe. They did bring back a few more, kind of like as a tribute later on for the movies, you know, for anniversaries of the movies, but the actual publication stopped back then. So that's it. Thank you as always to Wikipedia, Bustle.com, ESPN, and the film A Futile and Stupid Gesture, which you can watch on Netflix. I highly recommend it. It's a really great film. It has a fantastic cast, and David Wayne directed it, who's just like brilliant. He's so smart and funny and a great director. So, yeah, I highly recommend you guys watch that. And it's a really short movie. It's like an hour and a half. Will Forte plays Doug Kenny.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, he's really funny. Yeah, MacGruber. And Joel McHale plays Chevy Chase. And
oh, that's interesting.
It's really funny because when they cast him, they were like, listen. Like, apparently I read that David Wayne went up to him and he was like, you don't look or remind me anything of Chevy Chase. But the advantage that they did have is that because of Community, the show Community, Joel McHale worked with Chevy Chase, so he knew a lot about him. And when also, you watch the movie,
didn't really like Chevy Chase.
Yeah. When you watch the movie, you completely forget that. I mean, honestly, I thought he was great in it. And there's another actor, I totally forgot his name. The guy who plays Harold Ramis, to me, is like, it's crazy the resemblance between these two guys. Like, I forgot that that's not actually Harold Ramis. But yeah, it's really good. Thomas Lennon is in it.
I'm like, that's not a funny story.
No, it's like, it's just really, I mean, he was such a, you know, according to everybody, he was just like a super talented guy. And I think when they asked Catherine Walker, who was his girlfriend at the time, the actress from Shameless, I forgot her name, but anyways, she plays Catherine Walker.
Which one?
She's the main one. She's the daughter.
The curly hair girl or the...
Oh, Emmy Rossum? Rossum. Yeah. So she plays Catherine Walker, and they try to talk to Catherine Walker to see how they would play her, and she was like not interested at all. Mm-hmm. Emmy Rossum said she wasn't like mad about it. She was just it kind of gave her a little bit of like her answer to helping on the movie kind of gave her some insight into her, and she said like, you'll never be able to capture the brilliance of that man. Basically, like she just thought they could not live up to his like legacy. And I thought she did a really good job, but he was apparently a really brilliant guy. And so it's so sad because he was really young when he died, and could have done a lot more stuff. But so where can they find us?
You can find us on Instagram at Microwave Coffee Podcast, or you can email us at microwavecoffeepodcast@gmail.com. Justin?
Where's Justin?
Did he fall asleep?
Oh my god, he might have fallen asleep.
Did he die?
What?
Did you fall asleep?
No.
Oh my god. This is the best.
We're leaving this in. No, we're leaving this in.
Cut this part out. God. .com. Did I miss it?
Oh, this is a bet. Look, oh, Justin's having a really hard time. He's moving.
Yeah.
It's so warm in here, and I just chug this coffee. I mean, this beer.
Yeah, beer. Can't even remember the beverage you're drinking.
No.
Anywho, all right. Thank you, guys. We'll see you next week.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Could I get some more coffee?